IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hi, I'm Sarthak and I welcome you to yet another episode of All Things Policy. In today's episode, we will be discussing about judicial data regulation. And to discuss this, I have two special guests with me, Akanksha Mishra and Siddharth Mandrekar Rao. Both Akanksha and Siddharth are research associates with Daksh, and recently they have co-authored two interesting discussion papers on judicial data regulation. The link for the same is along with this podcast link. I would strongly recommend you to check it out. Hi Akanksha, hi Siddharth, welcome to All Things Policy.
Hi.
Before we go into the details of judicial data regulation, we have a small announcement. At Takshashila, we will be conducting a short course on evidence-based policy making for responding to COVID-19. This course will introduce the participants to the various public policy aspects of managing the recurring COVID-19 waves. It will be conducted on two consecutive weekends. If you are interested, please check the link shared with the podcast. Now, coming back to judicial data regulation, before we understand regulation, let us understand judicial data first.
So, Siddharth, can you give us an idea? What is this judicial data? What all constitutes this? Because, I mean, the idea here being, when it comes to data, we can classify it into different manners. So, what is this judicial data all about? How it is different?
So, judicial data, at a very broad level, it hasn't been formally defined as such, but for the purpose of what we've been talking about, We define judicial data as all data generated by courts, as well as data which is created through the processing of the data created by courts. So that we terms often used to describe this is further processing and secondary use. So judicial data can be split into the court records themselves, which is this basically all administrative and case records of the judicial side of courts. And the other side is the secondary use, data generated through secondary use, which I mentioned earlier. So court records can be further split into the what is called the case record, or which is basically any document or information which is generated by an individual court case.
Okay.
And as opposed to that, you have the administrative records, which is basically all of the records used to administer courts, which is not directly identified with any one case. So, for example, personnel records and, records pertaining to budgeting and inventory, for example.
Yeah.
So, basically, the court records can, it has come up in cases about what judicial and administrative data is and the difference between them, because it's quite important for the purpose of trying to determine right of access and things like that, which is something which very important from a regulatory perspective.
Yeah. So since you just mentioned what constitutes judicial data, now I just want to understand why this kind of data is unique. And the reason I ask this is, since you have been talking about judicial data regulation, that means you are saying that we need to regulate this kind of data. So why do you think there is a need for a different kind of a treatment here? So Akanksha, can you just highlight what is the reason why this kind of data is unique?
Sure, Sarthak. So before I go on to describe why it is unique, I just want to add one point that when we think of judicial data, we should think of it not only in terms of documents which are submitted to the court or generated by the courts in terms of like a judgment or an order or a plaint, but we should also think of it as information fields which might be generated or submitted electronically. For example, now we have this case management system where you use a particular software and fill up certain information fields. So when we are talking about regulation, it is important to view it as information fields and not just documents. And then going back to your question on why such judicial data is unique. So, you know, the judiciary has to follow due process when it adjudicates any matters. And this due process is very fundamental to the legitimacy of the institution as such, because it ensures a degree of fairness and consistency. And this due process in turn requires the judiciary to follow certain unique doctrines and principles. And these unique and doctrine principles are also applicable when the judiciary processes data. So let's discuss few of these unique characteristics. The first one which always comes to mind when we talk about the judiciary is the independence of the judiciary, that it is independent both from the legislative as well as the executive branches of the government. And this independence, it extends not only to the judicial functions, that is to the function of deciding a particular dispute, but also to all the other activities which are carried out in a judicial capacity. It could be an administrative function, it could be an adjudicatory function, or any court activity which is done in a judicial capacity. To talk about another unique feature of the judiciary is the nature of the judicial process itself and the role of the participants within that system when you compare it with other branches of government. Like in a court case, it is not initiated by the court of its own motion in general. Like PILs are a different thing. Sometimes the court takes suo motu cognizance. But in general, a court case is never initiated by the court of its own motion. It usually requires a complainant or a plaintiff. Whereas if you compare it to an administrative or a legislative process, that can be initiated without, you know, an interested person going and making an application. And then again, in a case, all parties involved have to be given a fair opportunity to be heard by an impartial judge. Whereas legislators and administrators, they often have very partisan interests and they support a particular interest group and they can act in their favor. And the third thing that distinguishes a judicial process from an administrative process is the fact that in a judicial process, the judge is limited to the evidence that is formally given to them. They don't go out of the way and discuss the case outside of the formal procedure. Whereas, you know, a legislator can obtain information however and whenever they please. They have no obligation as such to, you know, listen to all interested parties and, you know, hear complaints and address concerns of parties who do not necessarily agree with them. So these are some of the characteristics of the judicial process, which make the data generated within it quite unique. And the third and the most important feature, which I would say, is the principle of open courts. This open courts principle is basically when the public is allowed to go and witness a court proceeding in the courtroom. And this boosts public confidence in the justice system. It also enhances the public's understanding of how courts administer justice. But, you know, open justice has various facets. It's not just going to the courtroom and watching the proceedings, but being able to access court records, the widespread dissemination of judgments. One of the recent examples in India is live streaming of court proceedings. That's also a facet of open justice. So instead of viewing open justice as a unitary concept, if we look at it as a set of principles which allow public access to information, their right to know and understand the law, this will allow us to evaluate the operation of the judiciary and to ensure accountability of it. So, like, to sum it up, the judiciary and the judicial process have these set of unique doctrines and characteristics which must be considered before embarking on any discussion about regulating data within the system.
So, Akanksha, basically there are certain principles which are kind of fundamental to the working of judicial institutions. Like, for example, you talked about open justice. So, there should be greater access to judicial data, judicial information. This, in turn, ensures transparency, which in turn can ensure accountability. So, these are principles which we need to keep in mind while we are devising ways to treat different kinds of judicial data. Apart from that, you also mentioned about, apart from open justice, you also mentioned about independence of judiciary. You also mentioned about how judicial process is different from legislative administrative process. Now, I just want to understand, how do independence of judiciary, how judicial process being different from legislative administrative process, how all these things have a bearing on the way we need to treat judicial data?
Yeah. So to answer your question, I'll quickly refer to the new legislation which has been proposed, the Personal Data Protection Bill. And under that new bill, basically judicial functions have been exempted. So as such, there is nothing to govern judicial functions and data processing when it is carried out in exercise of judicial functions. So that's one thing, that there is a gap when it comes to judicial functions, whereas all other sorts of data processing has been covered under that bill. Secondly, how independence of judiciary plays into this. The thing is, under the bill, there is a data protection authority which has been set up, which will look into all kinds of processing of data done by various entities, various data controllers, be they from the government or private players. They will look into complaints. But can such a data protection authority really decide questions about how judiciary looks at data, what data the judiciary collects, or how they, you know, purport to use it, whether these questions can actually be looked into by an authority outside the judiciary, and how this will affect the working of the judiciary. So given that the judiciary is supposed to be impartial and take its decision on its own to preserve the integrity of the process, the data protection authority will not be the appropriate authority to, you know, decide such questions as to what data the judiciary is going to collect in a particular case. How or what use are they going to put it to? Whether it's just going to be for the purpose of deciding the case, or what data elements would they want to make available to public? These are questions which are best answered by the judiciary itself, because it involves the application of judicial mind, and the judges will be the most appropriate people to decide such questions.
Okay, so I mean, this is something which is linked with the doctrine of the separation of powers, right? So since we have different institutions, and they themselves have the domains in which they should operate, they have their own authorities, and yeah, so we need to keep that in mind while dealing with judicial data as well. So since your paper is based, or it talks about judicial data regulation, I just want to move one step backwards. As Siddharth gave us an explanation of what constitutes judicial data. Now, even before we move towards the regulation part, now I just want to understand why do we need to have regulation for judicial data? What is the need for regulation? I mean, judicial data constitutes different kinds of data, but what is the need for regulation?
Hi. So basically what's happening now is courts are gradually moving online, meaning that more and more of their processes can be performed remotely and digitally. For example, filing documents, if you have to submit some documents for your case. Now, thanks to the pandemic, it's been accelerated, but even before, there was a move towards video conferencing in court hearings for specific kinds of matters and stages of these matters. So what that means is, now we're already aware that privacy regulations and data protection regulations are necessary even for things like social media. Now that need is kind of accentuated when looking at judicial data, because the nature of information which is made open is potentially a lot more sensitive. You know, there's quite a lot of drama that can happen in a court case, which can be documented in a judgment or an order and put up online. There's quite a lot of drama that can occur in a courtroom. And if those are streamed, well, you need some way of mediating or protecting against the kind of harms that can be inflicted using the information that you can get from court proceedings. So how online access is different from... So if you're looking at the main things which are moving online access to orders and judgments, they used to exist in a state which is, like in the academic literature, they call it practical obscurity, meaning it's basically, even though by law, it's all members of the public are allowed to and entitled to have access to it, it's difficult to get. So you need to, like, just to get into a courtroom, you need to get a pass, and, you know, there's a kind of process to enter court premises. And then over and above that, you have to find the right counter and apply for it. And so this is when the records are in paper form. Now, it's just a matter of a Google search in a search engine or on a court website, and you can obtain the same document a lot easier, unless there's some kind of deliberate effort to make it difficult, like a barrier, like a CAPTCHA or something, to make it difficult for you to get access to it. The second point is, the reason why you would say it's necessary is because in electronic form, it's a lot easier, you know, with machine learning and natural language processing and other, you know, things which are getting more and more advanced day by day, to extract information from documents which are hosted online. The thing is, when with physical documents, possession of a document is kind of, it gives you control over it, over who can have access, who can use it. That doesn't apply to electronic files the moment they're made public. The moment they're made public, you can't control who gets to use it and what they use it for. Not anywhere near how you could with paper. And so this has quite a lot of effects on privacy. For example, online records can be a lot more permanent. They don't degrade over time like paper does naturally. There is a loss of obscurity. As I said earlier, people can easily search through online records. They can also be aggregated. So as you have a lot of scraps of information scattered across, you know, a person's online presence, whether it's social media, whether it's in official documents like this. But what happens is now it's become really easy to kind of combine these scraps of information and construct a sort of dossier on a person. You know, that's what people mean when they talk about profiling. And that's what happened, for example, in the Cambridge Analytica scandal.
A particular narrative can be created, basically.
A particular narrative can be created. And what happens is you can put together, you know, scraps of information on a person to create an understanding of them that's greater than the sum of their parts. So like you might know some detail about a person, but when you combine it with all the others, it's a lot more revealing than it would be in isolation. And so then this information is impossible to control once it's on the internet. It can be taken out of the context of the court proceedings. So all participants in a hearing have some background of, you know, the context in which a certain piece of information, so context in which, say, an event occurred or a person said something. Now, if you can extract that quite easily from a document, you can take it out of context and people, you can misrepresent it, you know, you can twist facts. And that's quite a dangerous thing, especially in the kind of time that we are living in where social media rumors spread quite quickly. Data mining is another danger because data mining can be used to generate insights to info facts about a person which they might not necessarily want third parties to know without their consent. And this is in addition to things like, you know, online fraud and privacy invasions and stalking, which is possible with information, very detailed information about a person.
So Siddharth, basically there are different kinds of risks associated here, right? And it can impact individuals. And to some extent, it can also impact the functioning of the judicial institution. I mean, it can also lead to a situation where the legitimacy of the judicial institution can be questioned in case the data is not regulated or data is not, I mean, it is not regulated or it is not treated in the appropriate manner.
Yeah.
You know, Sarthak, just to talk about an example here, when you're talking about, you know, the legitimacy of the judicial process. So one example that we heard from the United States is that certain members, they took files from this PACER. It's called the database of judicial records in the US is called PACER. So they got the records from there. Then they compiled information about all informants who help the law enforcement authorities. And then, you know, these people created a website called whosarat.com, where they went and they posted the photographs of these informants and their details. And then this led to a like witness intimidation industry out there before the, you know, law enforcement could crack down and arrest the people involved. But things like this fortunately haven't happened in India yet. But there is with this move towards digitization, we really don't know what all harm could come our way.
Yeah, so this is a nice, I mean, this is an interesting instance that you have pointed out. And yeah, these kind of risks are there. So, that's a fair point that we need to find out ways by which judicial data can be regulated. But now the next question, which follows up from here is, at present, right? So we have different kind of proposals floating around, different kind of ideas floating around about how data can be regulated. For example, you have the Personal Data Protection Bill in the parliament. So can't we use the whatever proposal is there right now? Can't it be used, or it can be, can it not be modified for judicial data as of now? Why do we need separate mechanism for it?
But before we go into the reasons for a new approach to judicial data regulation, let's have a small break. Coming back, we are discussing why existing data regulation mechanisms might not be apt, might not be sufficient for judicial data. So Siddharth, can you elaborate on this?
So, well, there's a couple of reasons. One thing which I think Akanksha has already discussed, the issue of separation of powers in some detail. But
yeah,
there's also the means of regulation and the kinds of, you know, mechanisms which conventional regulations rely on to deal with these issues, you know. So like the PDP bill and a lot of regulations have actually been passed in other jurisdictions rely heavily on consent. Now, there is no question of consent in a large proportion of judicial proceedings. Like a criminal accused is hardly going to consent to the use of data which can be used to incriminate them. So like there's no question of, you know, them relying on consent, for example. There's also the fact that because of, you know, the open justice doctrine and lot of the other factors that affect what information from court proceedings is made public means that a lot of data that would normally you would be able to restrict access to, you would not be able to do so in a judicial context. So you need to, the whole problem needs to be approached differently. The reason for that is, so that's the P in personal, in the BDB bill, you know, personal data. The definition of personal data, which is sort of the keystone of that bill, is basically data which can be used to identify a person. Now, it's a very important fact in a case, in a lot of cases, to know who is the, you know, who is the plaintiff, who is the defendant. It can really, it's a very essential fact. And you can't use the fact that it's personal data as a reason to withhold information from public access in a judgment or an order, for example. So the kinds of information and the kinds of factors that are used to decide whether or not it's made public should be completely different in the context of judicial data. There's also the fact that this sort of the way roles of people in relationship to data is normally set up in data regulations is quite coarse. You know, you have like the people who data pertains to, who's like called the data principal in the PDP bill. They're called, and then you have the data fiduciary, who are people or organizations which determine the use of data. And now it's just sort of this binary, and then you have an intermediary called a processor who processes data on behalf of a fiduciary. Now this is not nearly enough to kind of capture the rights and entitlements and obligations that people can have in the context of judicial proceedings. For example, the roles of witnesses, the roles of investigation agencies don't quite fit cleanly in this framework. So you need to regulate judicial data role-wise in the context of judicial proceedings.
Yeah. Also, to add to what Siddharth was talking, even the rights which are afforded to data principals under general data protection legislations, like the PDP bill. For example, let's talk about the right to access information. So basically, it means that the information pertains to a particular data principal. That data principal can go and ask for that information to be made available to them. In case of judiciary, I can give you one example. Under our criminal procedure code, an accused is not entitled to the case diary maintained by the police. Now, okay. Of course, the case diary will have personal details about them. And if you look at it from a general data protection legislation, they should get access. But if they do, that will again lead to, you know, dilution of the judicial process. So these rights and obligations cannot just be merely transposed into the judicial framework, basically.
Yeah, so basically the judicial principles and the mechanism, right, the entire process, I mean, it has some inherent characteristics. So to ensure that these are followed, we have to have a separate mechanism for regulating judicial data. But yeah, one question I had is, so since we are talking about judicial data regulation, and then there can be parallel mechanisms for regulating personal data, will there be any conflict between these, because you are now having parallel mechanisms? Is there any possibility of conflict between these two laws? There will be two laws, there will be two ways, or two different authorities, multiple authorities administering this.
Well, for the PDP bill, I'll just say about the PDP bill, I think Akasha, you could probably talk about the RTI and, you know, those regulations. The PDP bill already has an exception for this reason. If you look at the report of the Justice Sri Krishna Committee, they understood quite well about how the judicial context is quite different, and knowingly included an exception for judicial functions in the earlier draft for this reason.
So basically, even under the PDP bill, the exemption is very narrow. It says that courts and tribunals, when they are processing data in exercise of judicial functions, then the PDP bill won't apply. But if the courts are processing data in exercise of administrative functions, it is my understanding that the PDP bill will still apply. So in terms of administrative functions, the data protection authority under the bill could have, you know, jurisdiction over issues arising out of administrative processing of data. But that itself is problematic because there are no clear contours of what constitutes judicial function, whether, you know, when let's say a judge is deciding to, let's say, transfer a judge to another jurisdiction, or they're talking about appointments, whether such things can be characterized as judicial function or administrative function, we really don't know. So that element of confusion is still there. But it is clear that as far as judges are processing data in exercise of adjudicating disputes, those won't be covered under the PDP bill. Now, the other point of conflict is also with the RTI Act. Under the RTI Act also, generally people do, you know, file applications to gain access to a lot of judicial data. Now, the rules under the RTI Act are sometimes in conflict with the individual rules of the High Court for gaining access. So these are other issues that need to be straightened out before we have a different framework altogether for judicial data regulation.
Yeah, so since we're talking about framework for judicial data regulation, and your paper focuses on that only, so what do you think should be the founding principles or foundational principles on which this judicial, on the basis of which judicial data regulation should happen? What should be the principles? What should be the mechanism?
So before I discuss what should be the particular factors based on which this data should be regulated, just a word of caution here that, you know, digital processes, we understand that it has tremendous potential to play in the modernization of justice systems. However, these technological advancements, they are not an end in themselves. So we should be wary of unquestionably, you know, adopting these technologies without accounting for the particular uniqueness or the particular peculiarities of the judicial system, or let's say the core values of the judicial system. And when we talk about core values, I think when we are talking about access to judicial data or regulating the use of judicial data, then open justice has to be the baseline. It has to be the primary principle. Now, open justice does not mean that, you know, you make all records openly available, unfettered access. That's not what we mean by open justice. You know, since open justice is such a it has so many facets to it that understanding those different facets of open justice becomes important to understand how competing values are balanced by the judiciary. So with that, I would say that, you know, there are other factors which we can look into while regulating data. Some factors like, you know, the role of the individual in the context of the justice system, the sensitivity of the information sought, or the subject matter of the case, or, you know, the volume of data that somebody is requesting, the time at which somebody is requesting access. All these have some bearing on what can be made available and what cannot.
Yeah, thanks, Akanksha. So techno-solutionism is not the answer to it. But what should be the guiding principles here?
Yeah, so we definitely think that the role of an individual in the context of case proceeding is going to be one of the major factors in determining what they have access to, and as well as what their rights and obligations would be. Now, for example, in the context of data which is not made public, you wouldn't need to have different tiers of access to that data. Like, for example, judges, lawyers, and litigants should have access to all of it. Law enforcement need not necessarily have access to all of it, but only to the extent that it's necessary for their investigation. Witnesses need only have access to the content of their deposition, for example. So that's probably the most important factor. But even though we talked about how the kinds of categorizations of data that exist in conventional data regulations are not fine enough, some kind of categorization based on the level of harm that a piece of information can be used to inflict is necessary. So both in terms of individual pieces of information, like biometric information is in general quite sensitive because it's inextricable from a person. You know, you can't separate a person from their biometric information. And in India, because of Aadhaar, it's also tied to quite a lot of government benefits, and it's used to identify a person for quite sensitive situations, such as in your bank, for example. So that information, which can be used to harm you quite a bit, should be given a lot more protection. And over and above that, I think Akanksha mentioned the timing of access. So this is really important because at certain times, some information can be used to sort of affect the outcome of a case. It can affect the fairness of the outcome of a case. and the judge may choose to only make that information public after the case is decided. Finally, I think the volume and granularity in which data is made available can be have quite a profound effect on how much harm it can be used to inflict. And this is especially true in the digital context where you can, you know, you can, if there are no restrictions, it would be possible to download data from a large number of cases quite quickly, you know, and quite easily. So the reason why having such bulk access to data can increase privacy risks is because it enables you to spot trends again and build up profiles. And that can be used to discriminate against people. It can be used, I think a common example which people worry about is the use of trends spotted through profiling to discriminate against people in hiring for jobs. So suppose you notice certain characteristics through performing analysis on case data. You notice certain characteristics which are associated with people who commit certain kinds of offenses. And you discriminate against potential employees who are applying for a job based on those characteristics. That's the kind of thing you would want to prevent. But that information can't be used for these kind of purposes if you only have access to information from one case at a time.
You know, another interesting example from bulk access that I'm reminded of is from this Canadian jurisdiction, where they gained bulk access to data from divorce proceedings. And from there, they started targeting people with real estate advertisements. So really, there's like a tremendous scope for commercial value or commercial exploitation being made out of such data. Yeah.
So from the divorce data, so they're getting who are getting divorced, and they're again trying to sell a real estate property to them, or what happened in that case?
Exactly, because they know that, you know, when they are divorcing, people will move out of one house to another. So they are, you know, target customers.
Interesting case. Yeah, so just think of it, right? Health data, finance data, all these things can be used in different ways if someone gets access to it. So, this also brings me to an interest. I mean, this brings me to a question here is, let's say data, I mean, you're having a mechanism by which you are regulating data, you're trying to protect data, but there might be a scenario where some of these critical data is leaked out, which was not supposed to be leaked out. So shouldn't we have some form of a grievance redressal mechanism or some form of penalizing mechanism for those who would have leaked it out?
So currently, there are some remedies available under various statutes, depending on the harm which is inflicted. For example, if you have taken some private data and, you know, misreported about it, you could potentially have a defamation claim, or you could probably have, you know, remedies for breaches under the Information Technology Act. But there is as such no one mechanism where you can take all your complaints about judicial data to. And as we discussed earlier, the Data Protection Authority under the PDP bill, which is envisaged, which is not yet in place, may not be the appropriate authority to decide such questions. So what we propose in our paper is that there should be a completely different body for regulating this data, as well as looking into complaints against use and misuse of judicial data. So, like, for example, in the UK, what they've done is they have established a UK data judicial data protection panel, which is headed by a couple of judicial members to whom these complaints are taken. So we, in our paper, have also envisaged a completely separate body for looking into complaints against processing of judicial data.
So this is something which is interesting and I think is also important. Now, so till now, we have been looking at factors why judicial data should be regulated, how it should be regulated, what kind of mechanisms we should be using, what should be the founding principles. But the next obvious thing here is, how will all these things pan out? Like, so what will be the final implications? How is judicial data regulation, as you are proposing, how is it going to impact administration of institutions? How is it going to impact business models? How will it look in real life?
So one thing off the top of my head, if you have a safe means of, what regulations will enable is safe exchange, or safer. I mean, nothing is 100% safe. It would enable safer exchanges of data. And when the judiciary moves online to a point where most of their processes can be performed remotely and digitally, a lot of things can be sped up quite a bit. Now, For example, they can have interoperability with the systems in other in government departments, you know. As we know, a lot of cases involve land. If you have good privacy regulations, there will be fewer misgivings about, for example, having a system where courts can access land records directly in the case of a dispute. Now, a huge amount of delay is caused by delay in transferring records to courts. Now, if you have regulation for data can mean is that exchanges of data take place under strictly regulated circumstances and with oversight and grievance redressal mechanisms. So people are comfortable with the idea of this efficient exchange of data that will speed up proceedings, basically.
And just another example is the ICJS, which is currently under consideration in India, where there's data sharing between the law enforcement and the courts. These can really speed up the process, which I think is very essential given the amount of pendency that is there in our courts. The other example is safer exchange of data would also mean that these law tech entities, which are coming up these days, can gain access to bulk data in a safe manner where they probably have to sign an undertaking or get into a confidentiality agreement with the courts on what use they can make from this data. And this can help them to, devise so many, applications or softwares which can actually benefit access to justice. So basically, by creating an appropriate balance between open justice and countervailing interests, these regulatory framework can really, give us the confidence to explore the potential of technology in improving our justice system.
So to wrap it up, judicial data is something which is unique. It has its own distinctive characteristics. There are certain principles, norms that needs to be adhered to, and judicial data regulation that needs to take into consideration all these things. And this way, technology can be leveraged, and at the same time, judicial delivery system will also become more efficient, more effective. So thanks, Akanksha and Siddharth, for the insightful discussion. Thanks to the listeners for tuning in. I would strongly recommend you to go through the paper that Akanksha and Siddharth have co-authored. The link for the paper is shared with this podcast. Thanks, Akanksha. Thanks, Siddharth.
Thank you, Sarthak.
Thank you, Sarthak.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.